listening to WRBH Reading Radio for the Blind. This is the Public Affairs Show. I'm Carla Redondo, former chief meteorologist of Channel 4. I am visually impaired. I have retinitis pigmentosa, and I walk with a white cane. On today's episode of the Public Affairs Show, I'm with a familiar voice to many of you. You've heard him on the Writers Forum. It's the host, Michael Tusa, is joining us today to talk about himself, novels, books, his process of going through the interviews, and everything else about Michael Tusa. Michael, thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me, Carl.
Well, I told Amy Sims when I had her on is that we're trying to highlight a lot of our awesome volunteers and what they do. And since you have a great show here on WRBH, I wanted our listeners to get to know you a little bit more. Your show is on Tuesdays at 4 p.m., Wednesdays at 5:30 a.m., and Sundays at 1:30 p.m. and 8:30 in the evening. So, Michael, first, please tell us a little bit about yourself, history, where you're from, what school, whatever you want to share about who you are.
Well, Carl, I was born in New Orleans on Cambrone Street, actually, and then grew up in the greater New Orleans area, attended a couple of Catholic grammar schools, graduated from Rummel High School, and then bounced around, went to three different colleges. Ended up back here in New Orleans and finishing up my undergraduate degree at UNO, and was lucky in that I was a history major, so I got Steve Ambrose as one of my professors, which was certainly a plus. And then, not knowing what else to do with myself, I went to law school and did that for 3 years at LSU, and then got out, practiced law for—I didn't think I'd practice at all, but I practiced for 34 years doing civil rights work and employment discrimination. And during that time, I also taught 5 or 6 years, taught employment law for the LSU system in a master's program. And then I retired in 2017. And at that point, I guess, decided I needed to start looking for some other things to do.
And your relationship with WRBH, how did that start? What drew the both of you all together?
Well, let me say, what I first did was, and I do a couple of volunteer things, on Mondays during the school year, I tutor first and second graders in reading, and then on Tuesdays, I volunteer at the North Shore Food Bank for half a day. And so I was looking for something else to do, and this is a bit of a throwback, but long ago, I dated a couple of times Susan Rook, who was on WVUE. And I recalled that she had read at the station, and so came down, took the test. You know, you have to test. You got to make sure you can pronounce certain words, and started reading on Wednesdays. And then that evolved. After a while, Natalia happened to mention that the Writers Forum show was vacant and nobody was doing it. And she learned that I had a couple of novels out, and so it just I transitioned from just reading, which I still do on occasion, to doing the show. At the time, the show was, you know, it was just kind of sitting there, you know, so we had to kind of reinvigorate it.
So the tutoring, how does that go? I mean, that's got to be a little challenging, but also very rewarding when you see the progress of the students that you tutor.
Yeah, it's really interesting. They're either first or second graders. It's at a Title I school, Lyons Elementary. Now, I don't have kids, Carl, but I've learned that there's a difference between first graders and second graders. First graders immediately love you and you're their best friend. Second graders are a little bit more cautious, you know, before they decide whether they like you or not. But it's basically a program that Volunteers of America runs called SOAR. I wish I could tell you what the acronym stands for. I don't remember. But where they're testing kids and decide who has some issues or whatever, difficulty with reading. And they call them out and then they're assigned a mentor or a tutor. And we help them read and comprehend. And I will say, you and I are close to the same age. They're not reading, you know, See Dick Run or any kind of books. The books they read now, and I'm thrilled with this, are informative. They may be about how a military base operates, or they may be about nature or about the Amazon. And then they're tested on it. You know, we test them and ask them questions and things like that. So it's rewarding. I enjoy doing it.
That's amazing because I know reading is so important at an early age because I remember with my son when he was young, we would always read at night on weekends when I was around or during the day, during the week when I was, you know, there early enough. So reading was very important. And I imagine that is so important to kids, even to this day. But I do remember See Dick Run, and, you know, so I know there's different things now.
Yeah, much deeper. And the kids remember it. You know, I mean, for example, just in the last week or two, they read in series. And so they read a book on the desert, then they read a book on rainforests, et cetera. And my little guy will remember, oh, this is different from the desert because of such and such. And he'll remember that. So they're also learning in the process, and that's pretty neat.
Oh, that's amazing. Now, how did you get into writing? Because I find that fascinating, because I can't write to save my life, or, you know, I need Grammarly to help me with my sentence structure and everything. So how did you get into writing, being, you know, you started as an attorney, so how did that writing process come?
Actually, you know, I was thinking about this morning. It goes back a little bit before that, and I can't believe I'm recalling this, but it's true. I was in eighth grade. Our teacher, Mr. Allenback, assigned us, everybody in the class, to write a story, a short story, about life somewhere. And so people wrote about, you know, life in another country or in another state. And probably this reflects where I was in my life at the time. I wrote a story about two kids who were in a facility, and they didn't know where they were. And they run away, and the short story ends with them being captured and brought back. And as they're coming back, they see the sign outside, which indicates it's an orphanage. And he wrote a wonderful, you know, when you're a kid, teachers can have such an impact. He wrote a wonderful response about, you know, how creative this was, et cetera, et cetera. And perhaps that was the spark. And then when I was in high school, I wrote for the newspaper, mostly, you know, again, we're close to the same age, mostly album reviews and things like that. And, of course, in college, as a liberal arts major, all you do is write. You know, we didn't take multiple choice tests. And if you're going to be a practicing lawyer and a trial lawyer, which I was, you do a lot of writing. And so I guess it was there. And, you know, I've interviewed tons of writers on my show. And when you ask someone why they write, you almost get the same answer all the time. And that is that it's therapeutic and they don't have a choice. So for me, I don't know where if the seed was that eighth grade teacher or whatever, but for me, It's a mode of expression, and it's a way to explore ideas. And most writers, I think, if they live below the veneer of everyday living and go into the hardwood, most writers, I think, are exploring things. Even if it's a fiction book, they're exploring ideas, whatever. In fact, one of the questions I like to ask, which sometimes stumps writers, is, okay, you created these characters in your fiction novel, and you put them in certain circumstances, and they have to figure out how to get out of them. What did you learn about yourself when you did that? And quite often, they will say, yeah, you know, that's why I write, because I'm never going to be the superhero. I'm never going to be whatever the character is. But it forces me to confront things. It forces me to think about things. How would I handle this, et cetera? So I think that's the impetus. The other thing I would say, which, you know, you mentioned reading. A lot of writers will say they read constantly, and they get ideas from reading. Not plagiarizing, but they, you know, something prompts in their head. And I've been very fortunate in that I'm a little bit outside of the norm, but I love ideas. I love tearing apart ideas. And I've been fortunate to have friends over the years, and I'm going to do a couple of shout-outs here. My high school buddy, Rivette Daig, who had a wonderful military career, always challenged me on history. The guy knows more history than I will ever know. And then I was fortunate when I got to college, I hung around a writer named Gary Goche, who actually interviewed on the show. And he's a great poet as well. And then my friend Caroline Gandy challenged me about religion. My dear friend David Walker, who I practice law with, we were more likely to talk about literary things or philosophy. And so I cite those things because I think if you like ideas and you start exploring ideas, writing is a natural outlet for that. And so I think that's maybe a long-winded way of explaining or answering the question.
No, not at all. So in this process that you have with the Writers Forum, how do you choose the authors you want to interview? And are your questions geared more towards each individual author, or do you have some of the same questions you ask each author? I know you said about the process that you asked that one author about the characters, but that's interesting. Is there more specific questions you ask for each author?
You know, Carl, I try to read everybody's book, okay, which I think is different, okay, because if you listen to a lot of podcasts or whatever that with about writers, it's a lot of generic stuff, you know, where'd you go to school, et cetera. And I try to read everybody's book so that I can also ask specific questions about the characters, about the creation of the characters, whatever. There is some commonality. I think listeners and readers are probably most surprised to hear authors uniformly say, my characters, if I create a good characters, help me write the book. That sounds weird, right? I even had an author one time say that, yeah, my characters will say, nope, I'm not going to do that. And, you know, I have to retrench. But you're creating a character, you're creating a psychological profile, and the characters help write the book. So when I took the show over, of course, it had been vacant for a while. And initially, I had to just reach out. I would, you know, I read the Wall Street Journal, so there'd be a book review, and I would reach out to the author or whatever. I'd get online and try to find others. Over time, and by the way, that worked well. Richard Rhodes was a Pulitzer Prize winner. We interviewed him on the show. And Kent Kruger, who's a, I think, 20 or 21-time New York Times bestseller, those guys responded directly to me. Over time, publicists found out about us, and they're very happy to have you interview their writers. And so we have about a half a dozen publicists, different companies that keep in touch. One out of Chicago, Kay Publishing, which is a publicist, I should say, which is wonderful. They send me a lot of information. And they'll send you their books and ask if you'll interview their writers. And I confess that at my age, there's only one genre I don't interview on. And it's caused a bit of laughter because I know it's very popular. But I have tried. I cannot read romance novels. I have tried, Carl. It just doesn't work. But they're very popular. I mean, Bryce Harper claims he reads them before every game. So everything else, literally every other genre that's out there, we've done. And I've pushed the envelope a little bit. You know, we interviewed a guy named Gene Ambo, who is a photographer. And he had 40 or 50 years of photographs of rock bands. And you would think, how can you do an interview on that? But being a music fan, it came off well. His book, I think, was called Heavy Metro from a Chicago location. And we've interviewed horror writers, and we've interviewed historians. And it's really, you know, it's a very eye-opening show. And the comments that I get from people, we get some, are mostly from readers who find that their interest is developed in a book because they heard the author or they heard about a character in a book that they identified with. So at this point, the show kind of runs itself as far as getting people to interview. I get books all the time. I got three of them right now I'm trying to get through. And it's just thoroughly enjoyable. And for somebody like me that reads, I've been exposed to genres that I probably would not otherwise read.
Now, speaking of your reading, have you got a novel that you're reading and you're like, oh, man, I you're just not into it where you know you have to finish it, you know, or do you finish it?
Yeah, it does happen. And so I certainly have learned how – well, let me give you an example. We've interviewed some short story writers, okay, and interviewed poets about their books of poetry. I don't have to read every poem to come up with a list of questions that are specific to the poems. And the same thing's true with short stories. I mean, if there are a dozen short stories, I might read six or eight of them, and I can come up with enough questions and get the thematics down for that. But yeah, every so often there's a book that I just can't get through. Romance novels certainly being at the top of that list. So
I thought you were going to say sci-fi. That's what I thought you were going to say, because I love science fiction. And so I was hoping it wasn't science fiction that you were talking about.
You'll appreciate this. I haven't gotten the book yet, but I just had a publicist reach out, and Leonard Nimoy's son has written a book about him. And they're sending me the book. And I said, well, great, I'll read it, and then I'll interview Nimoy's son.
Oh, so, that's great. I'll have to pay attention to that one, because I'm a big Star Trek fan. So I know about the son and the book that was coming out. So awesome. Let's turn the tables a little bit and talk about the books you've written. Talk about your novels real quick.
Well, I have four of them. One of them is a memoir, but three other novels. And you know, it's interesting how they evolved. I came off the Appalachian Trail in 2005 and got sick almost immediately. And so I had about a three-week period where, well, eventually diagnosed with Lyme disease, but I had about a three-week period where I actually couldn't leave the house. And so I started writing, and that was the genesis of the first novel. I just had some ideas. I said, you know, I can't just sit here and do nothing. And so my first novel, which is called Advancing on Chaos, is really an exploration, and everything I write, I hope, is an exploration of some philosophical and theological ideas, pitting a homeless street preacher against an evangelical preacher, as since it was 2005 and hurricane coming, as a hurricane bears down on him. And, you know, it's a first novel, and there's a lot of humor in it. I was pleased when somebody reviewed it and said it reminded him of Confederacy of Dunces. And then my second novel was actually one I started in the 80s, The Death of a Best Friend Who Was Killed by a Drunk Driver. And it's a memoir. And it was also a time when I was trying to figure out what happened to me as a kid, because I don't remember the first 10 years of my life. And so I wrote it in the 80s and then just set it aside. It was more like therapy, writing it out and just leaving it alone. And then through a strange set of facts, which is detailed in the books, I have my youngest goddaughters, Rosie and Maddie, who is now Matt, realized that the book was about their aunt, who is deceased, and they had never met her. And so they prompted me to pull it back out, look at it, revise it, and then edit it and publish it, which I did. And that book probably has had more impact on people. I've made friends with people who went to school with Caroline, who is the young lady that was killed by the drunk driver, that I didn't know, who read the book and then reached out to me. There is a third book, which started as a short story. I'm a big fan of Charles Bukowski, the writer, and so the book is called Chasing Charles Bukowski. And what it is basically an exploration of relationships. You know, we all know people who go from one bad relationship to the next bad relationship, and they never seem to learn. And so it kind of explores that a little bit. And then my my most recent novel is a historical novel. I had read a book called Slavery by Another Name. And being a history major, I thought I knew all this history, and I didn't. So after the Civil War, the slave codes were eliminated, but the South instituted what were called black codes, okay, which were very similar. And then out of that came something called debt peonage, where basically the South, mostly the South, would pass laws that would allow them to arrest individuals for vagrancy, for being out after dark, for not having proof that they had an employer, all kind of vague things, the purpose of which was to arrest them, then fine them. They couldn't pay the fine. And then the plantation owner or the mine owner or whoever would pay the fine, and the prisoner was then required to go work for him. And there was a federal law prohibiting it, but it became very popular. In fact, and it is the genesis of convict leasing. The states then realized that this was a moneymaker. And so, for example, Alabama, I'm going to get my numbers wrong because I don't have them in front of me, but Alabama got involved, and at one point it became as much as 80% of their state revenue was by convict leasing. Anyway, I didn't know this story. And so when I read it, I decided to come up with a fictional version of that story with some history in it, so that people would understand and perhaps be prompted to go look it up and learn more about it. And that's actually what's happened. It's probably the book that has done the best. I didn't realize how popular historical novels are, historical fiction is, and it's good. And the responses I get on my website and things like that are from people saying, I didn't know about this, and it's prompted me to go look for this book or whatever. And what I did in the book, which is, I guess, unusual for historical fiction, is I have a bibliography at the back. So if you're really interested in a particular topic, you can see where you might be able to go read some additional information about that. And that's, you know, that's been fun. I've done some book club, you know, meetings and things like that on it. And again, I've had a lot of people reach out and say, I didn't know anything about this, you know.
I want to get back to a question I have about your writing in a second. But first, I wanted you to give your contact information in case a listener has an idea or they want to have some information or find out more about you.
Well, the best thing probably is to go to my website. Carlos, you might have noticed I wear high-top red Converse. And so my website is Red High Top Press. One word, Red High Top Press. You know, when we were growing up, folks didn't have a whole lot of money. These were cheap tennis shoes, right? And maybe it's a throwback to my memory of those days, but and maybe I have flat feet because I've run marathons in them. It's the only tennis shoes I've ever owned. So anyway, Red High Top Press is the place to go, and you can send me emails through that. Of course, here at the station, you can also get in touch with the station, and they get in touch with me. I'm always open to ideas. One of the things that I do also, even though we have all these publicists, is when I interview a writer, I'll say, look, if you know anybody else who perhaps doesn't have a publicist, you know, I don't care whether you're self-published or you're published by one of the big five, you know, refer them my way. And in fact, tomorrow I'll be interviewing an author who was referred that way. She's got a nice regional following, but doesn't have a big publicist or a big company behind her. And we do that. We've interviewed local poets as well as national poets. And so I do that too, and try to get, and you can do that. So you can get in touch with the station as well, and, you know, leave messages and I'll get back in touch with you.
Okay. Going back to when you were writing, how did you get that first novel published? Did you go knocking on doors, rejection? How did that happen?
Yeah, I used to keep them. I don't anymore. I had a good box of rejection letters from, and a lot of authors will do that. They'll put them up on the wall. And so I had to navigate my way without a whole lot of help through this process. And what I quickly learned is, you know, when you and I were young, there were small presses. I mean, Charles Bukowski was published actually by a press here in the French Quarter. Allen Ginsberg was famously published by a press out in San Francisco. Small presses that then became bigger, you know, through that. Those don't really exist anymore. If you watch television and you see, you know, somebody saying you want to publish your book or whatever, what the small presses largely are now is they are using the same things that self-publishers use. They're platforms. There's Amazon has a platform called KDP. Ingram Sparks has a platform. And you could do it yourself if you're smart enough. I'm not. But you can also, if you go through the small publishers, they use the same platforms. The difference, and this is getting a little bit down in the weeds, but the difference is if you go with a small publisher versus self-published, the small publisher controls your publication, controls your, you know, everything you can do. If you self-publish, you kind of, the bad news is you have to publicize yourself, but you have control of your book. The big five are tougher to get to, big five publishing companies, you know, HarperCollins and Random House, et cetera. They have their own in-house publicists, and I've dealt with them for the show. They will get in touch. But you can't, and it's a common misperception, you think you write a manuscript, I'm just going to mail it to them, and, you know, they're going to fall in love with me. No, it's going to end up in a trash can because they're not going to read it, okay? The only way to get to the big publishers is through agents. And you got to make sure you get the right agent. I went through that process, found it extraordinarily frustrating because you can't send your manuscript to the agent. The agent's going to give you guidelines as to what you can do and what you have to submit. So you end up writing a manuscript, then you end up writing two or three other things that you have to write in order to get their attention, maybe, okay? I went through that process, briefly had an agent, and then everybody starts hitting you up for the money, right? So several of my friends are published authors, and they asked the right questions. They said, why are you doing this? And I said, you know, I like to write, and I know I have some folks that will like to read it. They said, are you doing it for the money? I said, no, I don't. Thankfully don't need it. So I ended up going the self-publishing route with a lot of help because I'm not smart enough. So there's a local publishing group here, Cherry Press, who helped me put together some of my stuff. And there's a lady that I use who does all the formatting and does the book covers. I design the book covers conceptually. She then takes it from idea to finalization. And so that's what I went through. You know, I did the research recently for a friend who wants to be published by a big publisher. And the best data is that about 2-3% of the people that go through agents to the big publishers actually get published. So you're better off doing it yourself or going through a small publisher, unless your desire is to be on the New York Times bestsellers list, you know.
In the 3 minutes or so we have left, I want you to tell the story about the song that you, because I found that fascinating.
So I am not a songwriter, but I am fortunate to have a good friend who is Steve Giudice. In fact, I've interviewed him and Andrew Duhon on the show about songwriting. And I made an acquaintance with a gentleman who was at Khe Sanh in Vietnam. If you don't know about Khe Sanh, it was an awful place where the Marines got stuck. And he was there for 70 days. And I brought him down for Mardi Gras, and the night before Mardi Gras, we were sitting around outside where we were staying, and there was a parade apparently going on and some helicopters overhead. And Dennis kind of, I saw PTSD in real time. I mean, he just kind of went into himself. I kept asking his name. He wouldn't respond. When he finally came out of it, I said, you know, what just happened? And he said, somewhat bashfully said, I was waiting for the green smoke canister. Now, for those of you that don't know, when somebody was injured in Vietnam, probably still today, you threw out a green smoke canister to call the Huey pilots in, the helicopter pilots, to pick up the wounded. And that stuck with me, you know. And I had done some work with veterans, helped VOA a little bit, set up a transitional housing program for veterans. And so I called my songwriter friend, Steve Giudice, and I said, look, I got this idea, and I don't know what to do with it, but it seems like a good idea. And he said, why don't you write a poem about it? Because I've written some poetry, bad poetry, I might say, Carl, but I've written some poetry. And so I wrote a poem about it, and then he and I got together, and he's wonderful with the music as well as the lyrics. I learned a lot about songwriting from him, about rhymes and things. And over the space of, I think, 2 days, we came up with a song called Green Smoke Canister, which you can find on YouTube and stuff like that, Steve's versions. He played it at the opening, as an opening act for Rodney Crowell, and the military guy who runs the USS Kidd, the ship that's stationed in Baton Rouge, approached him after and asked if he could use it for the historical things that they present on Vietnam. So that's the background on the song. And again, you know, back to the show, back to Writers Forum, that was a fascinating show where I had two singer-songwriters in talking about the mechanisms of writing songs and learning about it. But anyway, that's my one song credit that I have.
Well, that's a fascinating idea and an experience that you went through, and it was amazing to hear, and that's why I wanted to share you to share that with the listeners. Michael, unfortunately, I mean, we need another 30 minutes or so. I mean, there's so much to talk about. I find this very fascinating, interesting about writing and all the authors and stuff. So, but unfortunately, we are just about out of time. Michael, I want to thank you for joining us. And you can listen to Michael's show on our air at Tuesdays at 4 o'clock, Wednesdays 5:30 a.m., and encore performances on Sunday at 1:30 in the afternoon and 8:30 in the evening. Michael, thank you for joining us.
Carl, thanks so much for having me on.
I've got to have you back again because this is fascinating. You have been listening to WRBH Reading Radio for the Blind. This has been the Public Affairs Show. I'm Carla Redondo. Thank you for listening.